This week on Your Western Context, hate crimes are on the rise in Canada, the Alberta budget sees continued support for healthcare, and another top military commander is under investigation. Also, Trudeau and his cabinet walk out on Parliament's Uyghur genocide vote. This is Western Context, episode 208, recorded Friday, February 26th, 2021. Taking a Stand. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back, as we are each and every week. And this week was a bit of a different news week, a little bit quieter than normal, but as they always say, that is probably the calm before the storm.
Yes, exactly. There's always lots of news, and while this week was a little bit quieter than normal, there's definitely still lots of discussion to go on and lots of different angles that the media haven't really fully discussed, as they're known to do, and definitely lots of topics that we will be covering this week on the show.
That's right, and if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through all the bias that you find in the media, online, print, TV, practically anywhere, and in doing so, hopefully we'll provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And if you want to follow along in full show notes, you can find those at westerncontext.ca, and we're starting off in BC this week.
Yes, in BC this week, the Vancouver Police Department released their 2020 year-end report on crime statistics and their conclusions on activity in BC's biggest city. And one particular statistic grabbed headline attention in the province last week, and lots of commentary as to what exactly was the reason for it. Now, VPD's 2020 analysis concluded that because of the pandemic, there have been less people working and driving to and from work, more people working from home, less businesses open and for shorter hours, and less general activity by people out in public. And that's fairly obvious, but those trends mean that overall, Vancouver saw less violent crime, but in general, serious assault cases rose, especially against police officers themselves. Total property crimes went way down due to more people being at home, but break and enters into businesses went way up instead due to places being closed more. So those trends that we saw earlier have translated to different crime statistics either going up or down based on how people have been moving about in the last year, and what has been a bit very different year in comparison to years past, of course. Now, what has gotten the attention of media headlines last week and has been an ongoing discussion on social media has been that hate crime incidents almost doubled from 2019 to 2020, and that anti-Asian hate crime incidents rose by 717% from 2019 to 2020, going from 12 all the way up to 98. Now, the police report doesn't delve into the reasons for hate crimes as it did for other types of crimes such as traffic or property-based crimes or assaults, but it's pretty clear what the main reason is, that the pandemic originated in China, and so people with hate in their hearts are taking it out on Chinese Canadians and other minorities that really have nothing to do with the spread of the virus into Canada themselves. Now, BC Premier John Horgan called the news of Vancouver's hate crime increase, quote, deeply troubling, and he noted that the BC government is planning on bringing forward anti-racism legislation this year. Horgan said that the government has been reaching out to police all over BC to reinforce the government's priority of prosecuting hate crimes. And he said, quote, we need to make sure that violence against people of color is not just treated as violence, but in fact, hate crimes, which carry much stiffer penalties. Horgan acknowledged that discerning between the two could mean that there is more difficulty in prosecutions, but he says that it's worth it to follow through. And he says he wants to, quote, make sure that people understand in BC that if you're going to turn against people based on the color of their skin, you will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. That's the message Solicitor General Mike Farnworth is delivering, and, quote, I expect law enforcement to follow up on that. Now, part of that is, of course, our quote of the week, because it's a pretty clear position as to what Horgan wants to put forward. Now, Vancouver is not actually the only jurisdiction in Canada reporting an increase in hate crimes. The Ottawa Police Service notes that an overall increase in hate crime reports of 57% from 2019 to 2020. Police there have said that the groups most often targeted by hate crimes are Ottawa's Black, Jewish, Muslim, LGBTQ, and East and Southeast Asian communities are the ones most affected. Now, the media will tend to report on this issue, but no one has any real answers on how to fix it. The police will state the statistics, but not the reasons for it. The government will prosecute, but they're not preventing anything, and ordinary people will be left wondering how exactly they can help.
And, you know, we look at this story, and this is something that we wanted to bring greater awareness to on the podcast, because, each and every week here, we talk about the news cycle, and the news cycle has been filled with one thing and one thing alone pretty much exclusively since this time last year. And, you know, it's just a tunnel visioning factor. The media, of course, always reports on the biggest story, but so many other things get swept under the carpet or just don't get their time in the sun. And it's really important to talk about those and the core aspects that come from that. And, you know, one of the perspectives that we don't hear all too often is that one of the things that has been missing over the last number of years in Canada, and especially through the pandemic, is a generic unifying factor, because, you know, we look at the way some of the governments of the country operate, and they operate on the principles of virtue signaling and identity politics, which on their own are wedge issues. And, you know, that goes to further drive the gaps that exist already in cultures in between people in the country, and it just pushes those people further and further apart in their viewpoints, and that allows these kind of racist and hateful views to come to the surface. And then that's my theory, at least, of how we see a 57% increase in a report of hate crimes over the last year and a bit. And, you know, it really all comes back to the fact that there is no unifying force in the country. You know, sure, you have unifying forces within provinces and whatnot, but there is no, in general, unifying force that rallies the banner of what it means to be Canadian, because there's always a push to show the different groups within our country, and in doing so, they practice identity politics and, of course, virtue signaling with that as well. And that just drives people further and further apart. But on the other hand, if we had a general unifying view focused on Canadian patriotism, Canadian identity, and Canadian values that everybody in this country agrees to and signs up to follow when they take their oath of citizenship, we'd likely be in a far better position today than we have been.
Yeah, I think one of the main issues with this is that while the BC government is, of course, taking a very harsh stance on people who do hate crimes, there hasn't really been a major support on this issue when it comes to the federal government. And the federal government under Justin Trudeau has oftentimes looked at issues relating to the Canadian identity or the Canadian culture, and saying that there is not very much that brings us all together. And I believe that Trudeau was very famously said that Canada is in a post-national state, in the sense that there is no inherent Canadian culture except that which is brought into Canada from outside. And I think basically people living here can understand that that's not really that true, because there are certain things that hold all Canadians together, regardless of their nationality or their background or their origin. And I think that when we talk about this in the media, there a lot of people will get into their head that this is not an issue, but it's quite clear that a lot of people have a lot of issues around this, and that it's spilling out into the general public. And a lot of views that people will just keep inside their head, people are being more emboldened more than ever to put voice to those issues that they have. And oftentimes they're not being carried out in a productive manner. And instead of taking part in organizations to help that which you think would be positive, instead they're just making racist slurs out in public, and it's not really helping the issue whatsoever, because not only are they committing crimes, they're not really putting voice to the viewpoint that there is a Canadian culture that people, regardless of their background, belong to. And you know, it's just something that's been continuing over the last few years. Certainly the pandemic has made it rise even more. But I think it's not just the pandemic. I think it's also the fact that there are less people working, unemployment is higher, and times are tough for a lot of people that even are still in the workforce. So, you know, it's a major issue that the media hasn't really talked about very much. There hasn't been much discussion about this one either, except on social media. And, you know, it's something that the mainstream seems to want to push under the cupboards. But it's quite clear that this is a major issue still in Canada.
Yeah, and you know, it also speaks to the idea that whenever the next election comes, if somebody runs under, you know, a simple objective of getting the economy going again, ensuring fairness and equality for everybody, and you know, bringing back Canadian patriotism, I think that's a ticket or platform that could be very powerful in all areas of the country. And we'll have to see if anybody does that. But we're going to move on to the big news out of Alberta this week, which was no secret in relation to the Alberta budget. But first, I'll just remind our listeners that if you want to support the podcast, you can do so via Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext, and there we offer three tiers of support for as little as the price of a cup of coffee, $2 a month. You can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. All we ask that you do is, if you want your name read out, send us a message via the Patreon inbox and we'll make that happen, because we, of course, like to respect our listeners' privacy. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Of course, you're probably wondering, what are we going to be doing with this when we reach $30 a month in contributions? We'll produce a monthly news article for Patreon subscribers, expanding on the topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information that you expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. And of course, we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So in Alberta this week, we of course got news of the provincial budget arriving and the beginning of the spring session. And, you know, the spring session is going to be an interesting one, because two of the very early key pieces of legislation will be citizen-initiated referenda act that will come forward and allow citizens to gather signatures and put forward an issue to the government, and enough people sign that, then it will be taken up by the government and the government will have to implement it. And, of course, the Recall Act, which will allow Albertans to fire their MLA if they act untrustworthy, spend too much money maybe, or maybe even go on winter vacation. So we'll see that after the Recall Act passes, just what kind of drive exists to fire the MLAs that took those vacations this past winter. So it's going to be a very interesting session, and this is going to be groundbreaking for Alberta in many ways. And, you know, one of the reasons that it is, of course, pretty much carrying on the same as we've had for many years, is that the province continues to have a budget filled with red ink. And with this, years after years, the budget keeps growing. It shrunk a little bit this year, largely, of course, due to the increase in the price of oil. But getting down to the numbers, the budget deficit for this year is set to be forecast at $20.2 billion, shrinking to $18.2 billion in 2021-22, $11 billion in 2022-23, and $8 billion in 2023-2024. The debt, of course, will continue to rise to $115 billion from $98.3 billion, and the 2021 forecast for the price of oil, West Texas Intermediate, is to be factored into the budget at around $46 this year and rising to $55 the next year and $56 the year after that, even though right now we see the price of oil hovering at around $60 a barrel. And of course, any changes in the global oil market, good or bad, will have an impact on the bottom line. And this, of course, can include actions by Saudi Arabia and Russia and any wars in the Middle East that the U.S. decides to get into. Healthcare will receive an additional $900 million for 2021-22, despite what the opposition critics are saying with this. Healthcare spending is going up, and soon after documents were tabled, the opposition NDP made the claim with media looking like banners on social media that looked like it was a news report that the province claimed to fire 15,000 healthcare workers. The government is also positioning for a $16 billion investment in Alberta Health Services for the Alberta Surgical Initiative, continuing care capacity policy, and the CT and MRI access initiative to make getting those critical scans much faster. Also included are billions for health infrastructure for health facilities, including five new builds, $766 million for Alberta Health Services, self-financed capital for things like parkade improvements and general building improvements, $343 million for capital maintenance and renewal of existing facilities are included in that. And the province has also included a $1.25 billion COVID-19 contingency fund for responding to the pandemic. Now, as we see here, this all, of course, fits on the side of health. So to say that health was cut, that's a gross overstatement in this. And, you know, looking at this, the budget also spends $1.7 billion more in capital funding and includes a $1.5 billion investment for diversifying the economy around sectors such as energy, agriculture and forestry, tourism, finance and financial tech, aviation, aerospace and logistics, and technology and innovation, of course. The province sees this as an extraordinary time and has chosen to spend to ensure that services will be propped up through the pandemic. And the goal for this budget is to keep net debt below 30% of GDP and bring spending in line with other provinces on a per capita basis, which is something that the finance minister said was job number one. And they, of course, still plan to balance the budget post-pandemic. Now, looking into what this means for cities will feel the pinch as funding for local infrastructure projects is going to be reduced by 25% over the next 3 years. And this had outgoing mayor of Edmonton, Don Iveson, visibly upset in an interview he gave after the budget. And looking at this, this will be a dynamic that all council and mayoral candidates will need to consider during this fall's municipal elections in the province. Now, while most of the big line items focused on the pandemic response and healthcare, there's still drive to balance the budget and bring spending in line. As we've talked about frequently here on the podcast, any economic argument always has two sides to it, and anyone who ignores that is foolish. And of course, that means we'll need to look at both the spending and the revenue side. And of course, we talked about the revenue side last week, how now is not the time to bring in new taxes. And that's a discussion that can be had in the future after the pandemic is over. Finance Minister Travis Toews framed the discussion going forward as not one of cost-cutting or removing services, but delivering services more efficiently. The pandemic has taught a lot of organizations many things about working online. Some are less efficient, of course, but some have also been forced to find efficiencies and do more with less, as has been the case in government. For specific job losses, the budget details a forecast of shedding 311 jobs, and this has been called the right-sizing of the public sector. The finance minister said that right now we're well on track with respect to the Alberta Public Service and our plans on right-sizing the public sector. It's also worth noting that the public sector compensation in this budget accounts for 54% of operating expenses at $26.7 billion, including $21 billion in wages, salaries, and benefits. And with this, we also just need to note that education will go from $8.32 billion to $8.24 billion in 2021-22 and hold constant in the following years. This is a decrease in funding of $80 million. Children's Services Ministry will also see its funding remain flat over the next 4 years. And as a bit of an interesting item in this budget, expected revenue from cannabis sales was only a third of that of which was expected. In total, this $18.2 billion budget deficit is the result of $23 billion in health services spending, $8.2 billion for K-12 education, and about $6.3 billion for social services and many other smaller pieces of the budget based off of a revenue of $43.7 billion.
Yeah, I think that provincial governments across the country have all been in a difficult time, especially when it comes to the province's finances, no matter what province you're referring to, just based on the extraordinary costs that the pandemic has incurred over the last calendar year. And there's definitely been a lot of issues surrounding health, but you know, there's been issues surrounding education as well, with the ability for classes to go forward and the size amounts that need to be done and the infrastructure being put into place for online education as well. So of course it makes sense that that health, education, and social services would make quite a bit of the budget this coming year. So it's interesting to note that a very conservative government in Alberta is spending quite highly on these areas, which many would consider part of social services. So it's interesting how the news cycle on this story has kind of not really addressed that, in the sense that they're not really cutting funding for a lot of these areas, but instead they're trying to retool the areas so that the amount of money that is being spent on them can be put towards the greatest amount of good. And I think that's something that gets missed when a lot of media talks about government budgets, in the sense that a lot of these are just big numbers that we don't really have access to the full information on until we see it later. And I think that's something that a lot of media doesn't really talk about very much. They kind of gloss over it, and instead they go for the big headline numbers of what the deficit is going to be and you know, how the province is doing economically.
Yeah, and you know, the question that always comes up in Alberta with these budgets is it going to be a scalpel, scissors, or a chainsaw that you take to the budget in terms of the amount of cutting that's going to happen? And you know, we've seen various levels of all three in this one. And personally, for this one, I'd call this the scalpel treatment, because you know, it's saving money through finding efficiencies and not necessarily, you know, just doing spending cuts across the board. And at worst case, it's holding things constant after this year. And we're seeing some increases in areas, of course, like health, which, you know, is something that in fact needs to be done through the pandemic. And without it, you'd be looking at a very different healthcare system. And of course, that's a discussion for an entirely different show, a different episode of Western Context, of course. But the fact that, you know, not even 20 minutes after the budget came out, the NDP was hammering this as though there were going to be 15,000 people fired as a result of this budget, that's of course a question that people need to come to terms with, that, you know, realizing that's just fake news from the opposition at that point. And most of what we've seen here in Alberta since the UCP has got in has been very slow moves in terms of righting the ship, righting the budgetary ship. Nothing like we saw in the 1990s with Ralph Klein. But at the end of the day, the province does want to get there, and they are still committed to that even through the pandemic. You can see that in this budget, and that's a welcome sight for many people who are concerned about that on the spending side. And you know, as we talked about last week, the revenue question will have to be answered down the road as well. And you know, this is something that the federal government needs to toy with outside of Justin Trudeau's infamous statement that budgets balance themselves. They don't unless you have, you know, copious drops of money from somewhere. But in any case, the federal government is occupied with another unfortunate and just downright troubling sexual misconduct claim this week.
Yes, that's right. Admiral Art MacDonald abruptly stepped aside late Wednesday night as Canada's top military commander after questions were posed to the Department of National Defense about a sexual misconduct investigation into allegations against him. Now, those allegations actually involve a female crew member and an incident about a decade ago aboard a warship that was participating in a northern exercise. Now, MacDonald has just taken over as chief of the defense staff post a month ago from the retired general Jonathan Vance, who himself is under investigation after a report emerged detailing inappropriate behavior between him and two female subordinates while he was in power. Now, Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan released a statement announcing that MacDonald has stepped aside voluntarily while the investigation is ongoing. In place, Sajjan has appointed Lieutenant General Wayne Eyre as acting chief of the defense staff, and Eyre is currently the commander of the army. Hopefully, the third appointee will be the charm, I suppose. Now, in his speech during the swearing-in ceremony a month ago, MacDonald actually apologized to victims of racism and misconduct in the military. He later told reporters that he felt it was necessary to make the apology because he was certain that he had been unintentionally part of some of the problems that the military is now trying to address. He did not cite a specific incident in his past in those remarks on January 14th, but he suggested that, quote, when challenged by some of the circumstances, I thought maybe I didn't hear a voice. Now, Sajjan said that MacDonald only learned of the investigation on Wednesday night and immediately voluntarily stepped aside, which is a sign of the military justice system's independence from the chain of command. Now, Sajjan said he himself learned about it recently, but he wouldn't go into further detail. Now, Sajjan said that the investigations into both MacDonald and Vance demonstrate that allegations of inappropriate behavior within the military will be investigated thoroughly, regardless of the rank or position of those involved. MacDonald's hiatus from the top command is another major blow to the military's efforts to stamp out sexual misconduct and violence in the ranks. It's also another blow that yet another top official appointed by the Trudeau government has been put under investigation for wrongdoing after Vance and resigned Governor General Julie Payette. Now, Conservative MP and defense critic Leon Alislev told the House of Commons that when the person in charge of eradicating unacceptable behavior is accused of perpetrating it, she said, quote, this leaves military members wondering if justice can actually be achieved. Now the military faces a reckoning that experts say has been a long time coming over repeated urgings to change a culture that former Supreme Court Justice Mary Deschamps called as, quote, hostile and endemic in her landmark 2015 report on misconduct in the military. Lena Tamseto, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for International and Defense Policy at Queen's University, says, quote, I believe based on the Deschamps report, which came out in 2015, it was well known that this type of misconduct was happening within the ranks, running from the bottom to the top. What we're seeing now is that this type of behavior is being shown through the top. Now, David Perry, who is the vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, described the situation facing the military as it grapples with the allegations as, quote, uncharted territory. He said, this is really a, quote, I think, a crisis for our military, no matter how the current investigations play out. I think it's tough to understate just how significant these types of allegations are against two successive leaders of our military. Now, it's clear that Canada's military leadership has a problem. One can only hope that going forward, the military can successfully reinvent itself and root out the causes of the systemic sexism and racism that is rampant at the top of the pyramid going down. Now, it should not be understated that our brave soldiers, past and present, that have protected Canadian freedoms abroad and at home, deserve no less.
Yeah, and this is the entire crux of the story here. And when you look at this and you see what's happening in Canada, you know, it would be a shock if this happened to one, and that's something you might expect out of different other countries. But two in a row within the same 6-month time span is just downright unacceptable. And I know still on the Vance case, there's lots of questions about what the cabinet knew and when that was brought forward to the PMO by Defense Minister Sejean. And, you know, we have to ask those questions as well in this case. And it's very early days with this investigation of, you know, was the defense minister involved? Did he inform the prime minister? And what exactly was the thought of cabinet in terms of going on with this? And, you know, you could say that, you know, they just made this appointment not too long ago and they're just coming off of the Vance case. But, you know, even then, there's a saying in leadership that the buck stops at the top. And whether that's the defense minister in this case or the prime minister, that's something that needs to be addressed. And this is a question that all Canadians need to be aware of on this. And, you know, it was really interesting watching the story this week because, you know, we, of course, have the conservative defense critic, Leona Aleslev, who has military history herself. But we also, of course, have Aaron O'Toole, the leader of the conservatives. And, you know, it's interesting that we really didn't see too much hammering this week from this. And they should have been absolutely totally controlling the media cycle on this. But that seems to be another area where they were absent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were questions by both Aleslev and O'Toole in Parliament to the Trudeau government on whether they know of any other investigations going on in the military at the same time, because it was clear that Sejean knew about the investigation that was happening against Art MacDonald before MacDonald did. And that only came out and was made public on Wednesday night. But Sejean himself said that he learned about it recently, but not exactly when he knew about it, and he wouldn't go any further into that. And it's pretty clear that something was up, but that only the government really knew about it. So I think there were a lot of questions there as to whether there are any other investigations going on, but the Trudeau government hasn't really said anything on the issue, of course. And, well, I mean, the media didn't really pick up on that at all from the Conservative Party. So quite clearly the Conservatives are asking the questions, but the media isn't really picking up on it. But it is very interesting how two successive leaders within the same 6-month period have, as you said, have come across these allegations that have come up against them, and that there are such major issues in the Canadian military. And it can be stated that in the past, you know, it was a different time back then, and we're now into the modern era, and there's a lot, you know, we're gone from the days where the Canadian military is fighting in major operations such as World War I or World War II. It's almost a century later from those, and the Canadian military has to rework itself in the sense that the efforts that the military is there to fight against are a little bit different than they were back then. So therefore, the conduct and the culture that surrounds the military has to be a little bit different than from what it was 80 years ago. And I think that a lot of the times things are the same, but they're not. And this is something that military leadership will have to look at and see what can be done about it. And again, the media has reported on this, but there's no clear answer as to what the solution to the problem actually is, other than the government actually, you know, appointing someone who doesn't have this history and who actually has the ability to change things going forward.
Yeah, and you know, there's a very simple, the only answer to this, when the defense minister finds out about these allegations, the only response to that person needs to be, you're fired and we got to find someone else. And, you know, in terms of change in the military is a very old institution. It moves slowly. And as they say in those kind of places, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So it's a good way of summing up that one. But we're going to move on into our firing line segment again. And this week, Canada has made international news with a motion that passed the House of Commons on Monday. And our firing line segment is, of course, the section of the show where we talk about a story that, you know, really didn't get the appropriate coverage or was just missed entirely. And this is one that didn't get the appropriate coverage and was missed for just the sheer gravity of it. And we're going to talk about the government's, in particular the cabinet's, silent on the Uyghur genocide in China. Now, on Monday, MPs voted to declare China's treatment of the Uyghurs a genocide, and this vote passed 266-0. For those who are new to this story, the Uyghurs are a group of about 12 million, mostly Muslim people living in China's northwest Xinjiang region. They have their own language, which is similar to Turkish, and see themselves as culturally and ethnically closer to other Central Asian countries than China. It's been reported that the Chinese Communist Party has been holding Uyghurs in internment camps, forcing mass sterilization, separating children from their families, and forcing individuals to undergo re-education. Now, going back to the vote that happened in the House of Commons, something that passes 266-0 seems odd, since it's the case that there's usually very close to 338 members of parliament that vote, or at least around the 330 mark. And with this, the opposition conservatives, NDP, and Bloc Québécois all voted unanimously for this motion. The government cabinet abstained from this vote by simply not showing up. There were a few liberal backbenchers that stayed behind to vote for it as well, but the government cabinet was AWOL on this, or absent without leave. The only member of the government to turn up was Mark Garneau, who abstained on behalf of the government. And given the way that the House of Commons work in Canada, an MP must vote either for or against any motion or piece of legislation, and there's no official abstention mechanism in the way the House of Commons works here in Canada. The move this week was also mirrored by the Dutch parliament, who passed a non-binding motion declaring China's treatment of the Uyghurs a genocide. But in the Netherlands, unlike Canada, Prime Minister Mark Rutte and his party at least showed up to vote against the motion. In the U.S., President Biden's administration has not declared China's treatment of the Uyghurs a genocide. And in a CNN town hall he gave earlier in the week, he stated that he gets it in talking about Chinese President Xi. He said he gets it. Culturally, there are different norms that each country are expected to follow. And when it comes down to it, this statement is loaded, and it could mean many things. From Chinese President Xi understands why the West is pushing this issue, but it just boils down to a case of cultural norms in his country. Or it could, in the wildest sense, be interpreted as that Xi knows it's wrong, but would have trouble making that case given the change and the way dynamics work in the Chinese Communist Party. Now, we need to be 100% clear with this, that genocide is unacceptable and all countries need to do their role to call it out. Biden has also made it clear that there will be repercussions for China and for China to become a world leader going forward, as they want to do. Biden says they have to gain the confidence of other countries. And while they are engaged in activities that are contrary to basic human rights, it will be hard for them to do that. So, you know, there's a bit of doublespeak coming there from Joe Biden, but at the end of the day, the Dutch government stands for something, and in the U.S., while not outright declaring China's action a genocide from the State Department, Biden at least admits that China has to improve its record on human rights. Now, as for Justin Trudeau and why the government didn't support the motion, he said that the term genocide needs to be used carefully, and it was a, quote, loaded word, and that we need to be absolutely sure of what's happening in China is genocide. The House of Commons also voted on a motion calling for the 2022 Winter Olympics to be moved out of Beijing, which, while largely symbolic, pursuing this is unlikely to yield any benefit. Bringing this story back to the people that this affects is something that's been largely ignored this week, and two members of Ontario's Uyghur Muslim community feel that the acknowledgement is appreciated by the Parliament of Canada, but on the whole, Canada as a country needs to do more. The Uyghur residents that the CBC spoke with want the government to impose Magnitsky Act sanctions on the Chinese officials in Canada. The sanctions would target the property, the assets, the holdings, and the wealth of corrupt officials who have committed gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. And when you look at what's happening with the Uyghurs in China, that's exactly what's going on here. Anwar Abdurrahman and Ryoki Turdish, who were interviewed by the CBC this week, both have family and friends living in China that have been detained, and they haven't heard from since. Turdish says that she has had more than 30 cousins who have been arrested, and those who have been released are afraid to speak out about what they experienced. They also say it's the most disturbing when you don't know someone you love is still alive, or if they're still in the camp, or if they're alive or dead. And this is precisely what the Uyghurs are facing, both here in Canada with their family members abroad in China, and of course the deplorable conditions that the Chinese Communist Party is subjecting them to in northwest China. And this is what our government is tiptoeing around, and in general, government administrations throughout the Western world are as well. This has happened before, and the horrors of the Holocaust weren't known until the camps were liberated at the end of World War II, and the world pledged to never again make that mistake. And you'd think by now that we'd have learned. But it's clear that for some, diplomacy out there in the here and now is more important than the lives that are at stake. And as Brian Lilly put it in the Toronto Sun this week, he says that when it came time to stand and be counted, the little potato was nowhere to be found. And of course, the little potato is the nickname that the Chinese administration gave to Justin Trudeau, and he and his government see it as a sign of endearment. And looking at this case this week, it's almost certainly as what they see him as today, the little potato, more so than a sign of endearment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's interesting how you mentioned never again. And that was the phrase that was put about after the horrors of the Holocaust were found out. But here we see the Chinese government enacting pretty much very similar actions against the Uyghur Muslims. And yet the world is not really doing anything about it. The U.S., Canada, and now the Dutch have officially spoken up about it. But in Canada's sense, the government was, as you said, AWOL on the issue, and they did not make a stand either way. And one could argue that that was in order to present a more neutral face on what is going on. But still, we see a report out from Beijing, from their foreign ministry, that they're still condemning Canada over the vote, regardless of whether the government was a part of it or not. So as we can see here, the Trudeau government walking out of the vote really only serves to condemn themselves rather than actually have any action on trying to keep China on side. And it's interesting how they were wanting to do this based on everything that's been going on with the cases involving Huawei, the problems with the two Michaels, and the case of Meng Wanzhou, the issue of travel, and of course the ever looming elephant in the room, the pandemic that of course started in China, and there was a lot of misinformation campaign out at the start of that. And it there's a lot of issues surrounding this particular issue, and I think that the media has not really connected all the dots on this one as well. They've been talking about how Canada's parliament passed a motion, but they don't really mention that Trudeau himself was not a part of it. And that's something that is really condemning of what our government is doing.
Yeah, and it only serves to embolden the Chinese Communist Party when it comes to their relations that they have with the government of Canada, and it's going to make things way harder for us going forward in terms of ensuring that when we deal with China as a country, we get a fair deal and our cases, as they need to be heard, are actually heard. Because if they know we're tiptoeing around on this, that's just a sign that when it comes to any other kind of negotiations out there, Canada is able to be bought and manipulated, so to speak, and that's something that's just downright horrible with that. And we'll have to wait and see what comes from this. good or bad, hopefully more good than bad, but nonetheless, it's a downright horrible story to hear, and hopefully things will get better at some point in the future. I think we can move on to our word of the week with that right
now. Yes, our word of the week this week is right-sizing, and that is meaning to convert something to an appropriate or optimum number, often in reference to companies or organizations reducing their workforce as the economy ebbs and flows and as the companies need to remain solvent and profitable. And, well, right-sizing can be applied to companies. It can also be applied to governments as well, as we've seen with the Alberta story this week. But also, you know, there's a lot of other places that it can be applied to. And it's interesting how the word right is at the front of that. And, of course, right meaning correct or the way that things should be done. And it's interesting how that is our word of the week when it can be applied to so many different areas.
Yeah, and, you know, looking at this as well, this is something that is a new word for many people out there, and this is precisely what the provincial government in Alberta was elected to do, and it's something that many other government levels all throughout the country should look at as well. And I think we're going to be in for a very, very interesting time after the pandemic is over. So we, of course, will be along for that to talk about whatever happens to arise with that, with the new moves in the spring session in relation to recall legislation and the Citizen-Initiated Referenda Act. But there's so much more this week as well, and you can find that all in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca, full supplementals for everything that we talked about this week. You can also, of course, subscribe to the podcast on any podcast listener out there. We have iTunes, Google, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, pretty much anything. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can also find us on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the stories of the week we're looking at, and of course, these podcasts. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all of the stories that the media talks about and a lot that they don't talk about in uncovering the real truth behind the stories that go on every day, whether they're in your newspaper, on the radio, on TV, or online, of course. And we'll be able to delve through them and find the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.